There are some cancers that we apparently now can establish quite hefty cure rates on, and others that still remain resistant to any methodology that we have tried so far. Our basic understanding of what a cancer is, what causes a cell to become a cancer cell, is still too elementary for us to get any advantage in learning something about how to treat it. So if we were to depend upon having the knowledge first of what causes a cell to become a cancer, we probably will have to wait another few decades before that is complete. However, I think that the sense that my fellow researchers, and in particular the clinicians who are oncologists, the specialists in cancer, indicates that we now can shift from what was called guarded optimism in the past few years to less guarded optimism. Probably within the next 10 years to 20 years, it is fairly safe to suggest that most cancers will be in the curable column. That doesn't mean all, but most. And fortunately, we at Michigan State have had a ringside seat at the new developments, the optimistic developments, with regard to the treatment of certain types of cancers, at least, and have made some contributions to moving a few of those cancers into the curable column. What I'd like to tell you about is the story of how our involvement emerged and what we have found and what is going on with the discoveries that we made in our basic research laboratory. Primarily, perhaps, as a technique of how research is done, as Dave had suggested, and also to indicate that there are a variety of methods of doing research. There is no one technique. Everybody practically has developed their own unique aspects, but there's one aspect of research that shows up very nicely in our particular project, and I'd like to emphasize this one. How does one go about finding a cure for cancer? Well, it appears that looking for it is the wrong way. That almost invariably, the major advances that have occurred in the treatment of cancer have been accidental discoveries, where people were not looking for that in particular, but they found something significant which they could capitalize on for the treatment of cancer. And our case is certainly a classic example of this phenomenon. It used to be called, well, it still is in many people's minds, called serendipity. However, I'd like to suggest that there's something even more subtle about it. In about the 1950s, there was an article in the Sunday Scientific, in the Sunday New York Times magazine section, which some of you may have caught. It was a new philosophic approach called resistentialism. The basic tenet of this was that nature is actively against us. Of course, it was the in response to Sartre, whose popularity was growing very rapidly at the time. And it was a very clever idea. The philosophy itself is a very attractive one to scientists because it's probably the only philosophy I know that is subject to an experimental test. And almost any one of you can do this test. And this is one of the standard tests for such a philosophic idea. You take a number of swatches of rugs and lay them on the floor in series of increasing expanse. Then you take a piece of toast and you put some grape jelly onto the toast on one side. And you stand over each swatch and you toss the toast into the air. And you see where it lands on whether grape jelly down or grape jelly up. And you do this statistically for each piece of rug. And what you find is that, statistically speaking, the number of times it falls grape jelly down increases with the cost of the rug. Now, from this philosophy, one can derive two corollaries. One is that you will find what you're not looking for. Serendipity is a specialty in that category. The other one is you will not find what you are looking for. And that's what happened to us. Both corollaries have been verified by our experience. Now, what was our experience? We did not start out, as I say, looking for a cure or treatment of cancer. We started out to do a simple basic experiment in what I would call biophysics, or the application of physical understanding to biologic processes. I was trained as a physicist, and after my PhD, I started to become interested in this new emerging field of biophysics, and one of the first things I did was to open up a book on biology. I never did take a course in biology in school, simply because I couldn't pith a frog. But one of the things I saw amazed me, and I was rather intrigued by it, and that's shown on the first slide. Can you turn the light on, please? The slides. All right. What it is probably familiar to most of you. It's a schematic picture of a cell in the process of dividing, which is standard and goes on in all of our bodies. I think that could stand just a bit more focusing. All right, what you have is a cell that has now established an orientation with two poles in the nucleus of the cell, or around the nucleus of the cell, which then dissolves. Then you go on to form what's called the spindle fiber, and the genes that give you the genetic information which codes the cell now begin to have replicated and are splitting into two batches, each side getting a complete set of genes. And so you then have the genetic material split into the two sections of the cell, and it goes on to form a sort of an indentation, a cross wall, and finally the cell separates into two daughter cells, each one with a full complement of the nucleic acid, the DNA. What intrigued me was this picture here, because to a physicist, that suggests something quite different. Namely, the kind of a picture one would get if you took a bar magnet, put a sheet of paper over it, and sprinkled it with iron filings. It's a dipole field, as we call it in physics. And this could be a negative pole of a magnet and the positive pole, or if you go to electricity, this could be a negative charge and a positive charge, and these would be the lines of force around those two charges. I speculated on this for a while and then read some more, and I found out that others had indeed been struck by that parallelism between the picture of a cell in division and the picture of a dipole field in physics. And nobody had ever done any experiments to test it. Well, we decided to test it. What we looked at it was this way, how we looked at it. If this is indeed a dipole, then if you come along with an electromagnetic field of the right frequency, it will just resonate, just like an antenna for your radio. It just resonates at the right frequency, and it picks up energy from this field. Well, if it does pick up energy, then you're pouring energy into the cell. If you're pouring energy into the cell, perhaps it might do something of damage to the cell. You can see already that there was some idea that we might want to selectively damage the cells in the back of our minds. Obviously, its application to cancer was there, but we never seriously considered it in the early stages. The basic idea then was to tickle this with the right frequency and see if you could affect the ability of the cell to divide. How do you do this? Well, we did a very simple system. We took a chamber, a little glass chamber, and we pumped into it a nutrient fluid which will keep the cells alive. We then put a little overflow tube on it so it kept the volume of the chamber constant. And therefore, after a while, there was a standard volume in the chamber, and now we inoculate that with the cells we want to grow. And after a period of time, it comes to a steady level, a constant number, because as the cells are growing, some of them are being washed out. This is called a continuous culture apparatus, and the cells are floating free in the material. To test it, we used a simple bacterium called E. coli, which is the standard gut bacterium we all have. The system was designed initially for this particular kind of bacterial work, but we were going to use it for mammalian cells, but we started out to test it with bacterial cells. Now, how do we apply the electric field? What we did was to simply take two platinum electrodes and dip that into the cell, into the chamber where the bacterial cells were growing. And then we hooked it up to a Scott amplifier, a standard high fidelity amplifier. And we just simply fed a signal in of the right frequency from an audio oscillator. And so we were able to control the frequency and the power level with the standard amplifier. And now we simply watched as what happened to the cells as we turned the electric field on. Well, what happened was is that the chamber was in danger of going aseptic. The bacteria were disappearing. And we didn't know what was going on until we took a look at what was happening in the to the bacterium themselves, and they emerged in that overflow tube. The next picture shows a scanning electron microscope picture of what these bacterium look like. They're rods. They're about 5 millionths of an inch long and about 1 millionth of an inch in diameter. And they normally grow to twice their length, and then a cross wall forms, a cross septum, and they divide into two cells. This is the process of bacterial growth or division, where the cells simply divide into two daughter cells. When we looked at the bacterium after we had turned the electric field on, what we saw was neither a subtle nor sophisticated effect, but at the same magnification, those bacterium looked like this, a bowl of macaroni. We were not looking for something that was trivial. It was a very obvious, blatant effect, and we knew that the electric field caused it, because when we turned the electric field off, eventually all the bacteria returned back to their normal sizes. And so we thought we had found the process we were looking for, namely the electric field control of the cell division. Because what's obviously happening here is that these enormous filaments means that the bacterium are growing and continuing to grow, but they're not dividing. So we found a way of stopping cell division in bacterial cells by this technique. And it was the electric field effect, presumably. Well, with this as an assay technique, then, we started to look for what the mechanism might be. And after a few experiments, it became quite obvious to us that it really had nothing to do with the electric fields itself acting on the bacterium, but the electric fields was causing a small amount of the platinum, a presumably inert material, to go into solution in a few parts per million as a very special chemical. And it took us 3 years of detective work to find out what that chemical was, and that chemical is the one that we are now using to treat cancer patients. It's called cisplatin now. Its structure is shown, overshot the mark. Its structure is shown here in the upper left-hand corner. It has a structure somewhat like a square sheet of paper with a platinum atom in the center. And then on one side, there are two ammonia molecules, the standard ammonia that you smell when you wash your floors. And then on the other side, two chloride molecules, same as in sodium chloride. A very simple, small molecule, but with a very fascinating history. This new drug for treatment of cancer was discovered in 1845. The problem was that there were two chemicals with the same number of atoms around it that could be made, but they had different properties. And the two were discovered within a few years of each other. It wasn't until the turn of the century that some fellow, Werner, in Germany, got the very clever idea that the differences between these two chemicals are how these four are disposed in the different corners, because one can make two different structures. You can either put the two chlorides on the same side, or you can put them diametrically opposite each other. The opposite ones, of course, are called the trans compounds, and when they're on the same side, they're the cis compound. And so on the basis of this understanding of the structure and the proof that came after that, we were able to establish the basis for coordination chemistry. And so this simple little molecule has a very noble history in terms of its chemical applications and understanding. But nobody knew that it had any interesting biology. And that was what we have added to the development, simply by showing that it had that beautiful effect upon the bacteria. Well, we began to pursue this study because it was a rather unique effect. No other chemical we knew of caused that particular kind of effects upon the bacterium. All right? We had a simple assay system, namely just looking at the bacterium under a microscope and then doing various things to the chemicals and seeing what effects it has. And it turned out that there were some rather intriguing effects. For example, we found that if you take other kinds of platinum salts that are not this neutral type of a molecule, where you have a 2+ charge on the platinum and you have 2 negative charges on the chlorine canceling each other, and this have no charges, so entirely this is a neutral molecule. But if you took some which were salts, like sodium chloride type salts, these were beautiful bactericides. And this was an area we thought was very exciting because it worked against both gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria, which generally most antibiotics don't work against. However, as we pursued this further and the newer properties emerged, the use of it as a treatment for bacterial infections became less significant, and we pushed it aside into a cul-de-sac, and unfortunately we never got back to it to be able to understand what the mechanism might be and whether it might be usable. By the way, I should point out that in proof of that second corollary that I mentioned, that we finally did do the test I suggested of trying the effect of the electric fields and doing it properly without platinum electrodes, which confused the whole issue, and of course it didn't work. But what we did find after starting out looking for a physical technique for controlling cell division was a chemical technique for blocking cell division, and of course that was sufficient for us to want to pursue it. All right, so we found that they were bactericides. There were a lot of other bacterial properties that we studied, all under the sponsorship of grants from the National Institutes of Health. We came to a time, however, when the grant was running out, we had to put in for a renewal. And we wanted something rather spectacular in order to guarantee that the grant would be renewed. And so we finally made the intuitive jump of testing this on tumor cells. And what we did was to find a person on campus who had mice with tumors growing in them and a technique for transplanting them, and we learned from him, and my associate, Mrs. Van Kamp, was responsible for most of the that kind of work. And what you do there is you take a solid cancer that's growing in an animal and you cut it up into little fragments, little pieces of about 10 milligrams each, and then you implant it under the armpit of a virgin mouse. That virgin, that is, in the sense that it's never seen a tumor before. And now what you do is you allow it to establish itself for one day. That's day zero. On day one, you then inject the drug that you want to test after you've established what level will kill the animals, what level is acceptable to the animals, and so forth. All right, we did that experiment, and we found that after day 8, when the controls had very large tumors, the treated animals had no tumors. And at first, of course, we thought that we had done something foolish and killed the tumor or done something before we had done anything to the animals with it. We weren't very sure of ourselves, so we repeated it at least a dozen times. And each time it repeated beautifully. Controls worked beautifully, and the treated animals showed no growth. We then became convinced that, indeed, there was some anti-tumor activity in the platinum drug. We tested about 4 different complexes about that time, and they were all quite active, but they were all fairly similar. In fact, these are the 4, in terms of their structures. Well, when we reached that point, we then contacted a friend of mine at the National Cancer Institute and suggested to him that we had a new class of chemicals which had never been looked at before, and that they might be interested in trying them. And they invited me down to give a lecture about the work, and I did so, of course. And I noticed that there was a very cool atmosphere prevailing in the lecture hall when I gave the talk, primarily because the medical doctors looked up at me and said, that quizzical look, "Are you suggesting we give heavy metal poisons to humans?" And I said, "Yes, if it's going to be turning out in the tests to be usable." And the reason that they asked such a question is an interesting example of faddism in science. Because if you go back in history, you find that the first real solid chemotherapy, the specific chemotherapy for a disease discovered in the early 1900s by Paul Ehrlich, was Salvarsan 606, the specific against syphilis. It was an arsenical compound. And here it was, a metal compound that was being used to treat a specific disease successfully. Why didn't it continue to develop in the use of metal compounds in medicine? Well, it didn't, simply because about the same time organic chemistry began to grow, biochemistry began to emerge from the organic, The discovery of the sulfonamides in the 1930s, and then later on the discovery of the antibiotics, sort of pushed the interest in metals aside so that we rarely ever use any metal complexes or chemicals in medicine today. And in fact, the standard textbook on pharmacology, which all medical doctors must read and memorize practically, it's about that thick, Goodman and Gilman, has a chapter in it on heavy metals. The second paragraph of that chapter says that the only reason for a chapter on heavy metals in a textbook of modern pharmacology is to lay the final nails in the coffin in the use of metals in medicine. And that's the attitude of all medical doctors today. Unfortunately, the revised edition hasn't come out yet. I'm hoping that they will change that. So, what we have then is that the Cancer Institute was a little bit unhappy about the idea of testing metal complexes. After all, they had tested approximately 300,000 compounds by that time looking for anti-cancer activity. Out of those large numbers, only about a dozen were metal complexes, and none of them had any activity. This gives you a numerical example of the extreme prejudice of the medical doctors against the use of metals. I left the four compounds there, and since the law requires that they test any chemicals submitted by a, quote, authentic source, and I presume to them I was an authentic source, they did do the tests on a different tumor system than we had done, and about 2 months later they called me and asked if I would be interested in submitting a grant proposal to them to expand this work, since it had turned out that it is quite active against their standard screening tumor as well. And I assure you, I submitted one with alacrity, and they've been supporting the work ever since. But while they were doing that, we did something quite different. And this was the first indication we had that we should not let go of it. And by the way, this is the only picture I'll show you of cancer, so those of you who are queasy about it, don't worry. Here is that solid sarcoma 180 growing, and by day 8, you can see that it's a fairly large-sized solid cancer, weighing about 1 gram in a 20-gram mouse. It's a substantial part of the mouse. By about day 20, it's grown to about 3 grams in size, and it invariably kills the animal sometime between days 20 and 35. Now, what we did was we changed the protocols that the Cancer Institute standardly uses, and we tested the compound against these kinds of cancers, advanced cancers. And here is a single example taken from another set of such animals, which were treated with a single injection of the cisplatin drug. And we gave the injection into the intraperitoneal cavity, the gut of the animal. About 4 days later, you begin to see a necrosis or blackness forming in the central core of the tumor. And indeed, the animal starts to groom it out, or we have seen it actually fall out on the floor of the cage. The wound heals, and the animal goes on to live a normal life expectancy, dying of normal causes, and up to about 11 months later, which is the latest that we had tested it, they completely reject any attempt to reimplant this tumor into the animal. They've already developed an immunologic reaction against it. Now, this intrigued us for one simple reason. No other anti-cancer drug known today even can do this. And we can do it with 100% ease. Every one of the animals is cured. So we knew we had something that was more than just of passing interest. The Cancer Institute also, of course, later on, over the years, after doing lots of studies against different cancer systems in animals, began to push one of our drugs, up to clinical trials. And usually these are done by what they call the three-phase system. Phase one system is after they have done tests on dogs and monkeys, which are done just to see what kind of effects the drug has on the normal organs of the body, what kind of side effects we can anticipate, the so-called pharmacology and toxicology studies. They then have established a low-dose level at which they can safely put into human beings. That's what they come out of the animal tests with, plus some ideas to what the side effects are that they could anticipate when they go into human beings. And then in about 1972, clinical trials were started with phase one patients. Now, phase one patients mean that the patient is non-responsive to all standard modalities of treatment. They have failed. They are also in a very poor physiologic status by that time because of the metastatic cancers that usually are throughout their bodies. Their immune system is very much depressed because of all the previous drugs that they have taken, or X-ray or radiation therapy. And so they're rather poor candidates for giving any significant information. But they are indeed very brave souls, because they are required to give informed consent, which means that they're told by the doctor that we want to use you, in essence, as an experimental animal. We don't know if this drug is going to do anything for you at all, but we may learn something from it which will help others. And these people do volunteer for this treatment. We did find in those phase one clinical studies that there were a number of interesting responses in two tumors particularly, testicular cancers in men and ovarian cancers in women. And there were two different laboratories that were clinics rather, that were involved in these two different studies. And the results were sufficient to stimulate a significant amount of further activity in the phase two trials, where now you can give this as a first drug to patients rather than a last drug. And of course, you invariably get better responses when you do so. And we were not disappointed. Those responses were very good. And we were able to get a number of patients into complete remissions. However, those remissions were of short duration. And this is really, truly one of the frustrating things about were of short duration. And this is really, truly one of the frustrating things about cancer chemotherapy. You're able to make masses of tumor disappear. And I mean masses. Pounds of tumors have disappeared. And then, after a period of time, they start to come back again, and they're resistant to the drug that made them disappear in the first place. A very frustrating phenomenon. Nevertheless, we were able to get some into remission by this process, but we also learned some serious side effects that bothered the doctors enormously, and that was that it damaged the kidney. And the reason why it bothered them was because most of the oncologists and the drugs that they have used do not come across this kind of a kidney damage, and therefore they didn't know how to handle it and what to do for the patients. And so this sort of threw everything into a static situation for a period of about 2 years. In 1973, at our first major meeting in Oxford University in England, the clinician's attitude could be summed up by the expression that one doctor from Texas specified, "This drug is too good to drop but too hot to use." It wasn't until about 1975 that a group of doctors at Sloan Kettering Institute, and particularly one young man, Dr. Esteban Svitkovich, came up with a very simple pharmacologic trick that removed the kidney toxicity. And it was quite trivial. He tested it on dogs first. It worked. And he then went on to humans with it. Now, he said this. All right, we have a platinum, which is a heavy metal, and it's causing damage to the kidneys. Well, we know heavy metal salts cause damage to kidneys, and we know that you can treat this by simply putting a lot of liquids, water, through the patient and giving him a diuretic agent, which makes them urinate extensively. Well, let's try that with the platinum. Well, his reasoning was wrong, because the type of damage that the platinum does is quite different than the damage that's done by lead or mercury. But nevertheless, the experiment turned out right. It's a classic medical experiment. Wrong reasons, right results. And so they started to hydrate the patients, to simply put lots of fluids through them, drink a lot, even put IV drips in and so forth. And they found that they were able to increase the dose by a factor of 3 and still get quite excellent anti-cancer activity. That is, it did not wash the drug out of the system, but it protected the kidney. Well, now we moved into the high-dose therapy, and that started to give us even more significant results. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, at NCI, National Cancer Institute, another study was going on, which also led to an even more interesting development. The success that we're having today in the treatment of cancer, for those which we can treat, comes about primarily because we use a combination of drugs, not a single drug. It is rare to find any cancer where a single drug is better than a combination. The studies that were done under the National Cancer Institute were to test the platinum drug in combination with almost all other anti-cancer drugs in animals. And it was found that it worked either additive in terms of their anti-cancer activity or synergistically, which means an improved result that you could not anticipate from just the two drugs separately. It turns out that for some still unknown reason, that platinum drug is additive or synergistic with every known method of treatment of cancer. And that includes radiation therapy and, most recently, hyperthermia, heating the patient to a slightly elevated fevers. And so we have the basis set for an enhanced availability of the platinum drug in treatment of almost all of the standard tumors. What you do is you take advantage of the fact that the clinicians have, over the years, very slowly, very laboriously evolved a complex methodology, a protocol, or whatever you want to call it, of drugs for a given type of cancer, which gives you the maximal response for that cancer. And what we're suggesting, or had been suggested earlier, was to take the platinum and then just add it to these other combinations. And it should improve the results. And indeed, that's exactly what has happened. There are a number of human cancers now where we're beginning to get quite substantial value to the patient in the treatment. Let me tell you the story of one of them in a little detail and then some of the others a bit more sketchily. The pride of place must go to testicular cancer. We've already seen from what I said earlier that the platinum drug was quite active by itself against the testicular cancer, but it did not produce long-term remissions. However, there had been a therapy that was evolved at MD Anderson Hospital of a treatment of testicular cancer using two other drugs, bleomycin and vinblastine, which was able to put about 40% of the patients into complete remission. But they only lasted so for about 6 months, and then the tumor came back with a vengeance and the patients inevitably died. And I should point out that it's not a trivial cancer, despite the fact that only about 0.5% of all cancer cases are this type of cancer. It is the major cancer in young men between the ages of 15 and 35. Now, when this material on the platinum came out about its activity, it was then added to this combination therapy by two different groups in two different, slightly different ways. One was done at University of Indiana by Larry Einhorn. Another one was done at the Sloan Kettering Institute in New York City. But they're beginning to converge now on a common treatment. But what happened was that about 60 to 70% of the patients went into complete remission. And these were, by the way, advanced metastatic cancers where it had spread from the testicles up into the lung area, and you can see it on the lung X-ray pictures. And they were surprised and happy to see that these tumors zoomed down and disappeared within a few weeks of the therapy. The question then became of how long would they remain in remission? It turns out, very long time, to the point now of where the doctors can now say these patients are cured. With recent advances now, and the latest reports we've seen, 85% of the patients with advanced metastatic testicular cancers will be put into complete remission and remain so for at least 5 years or more, so that we can now say that it meets the standard criteria for a cure. Now, let me explain what I mean by a cure. You can use the word cure as a verb or a noun. To cure someone is to do something which gets rid of the disease that's threatening them. And occasionally we have seen such cures in cancer patients. But on the rare occasion, 1%, 0.5% or so of different types of cancer. This is not medically satisfying. What we mean by the noun sense of a cure is one that all patients respond. Not just 10 or 20% of them, but all patients. Two, that the response be a complete response. The disappearance of all symptoms of the disease. They're now in a no evidence of disease status. The third criteria is that they remain in that status for a significantly long time, so that based upon prior experience, we can be fairly certain that they will not relapse. The tumor will not reappear. Under those three criteria, the clinicians now state that testicular cancer is curable. We lose 15% of the patients, not because they didn't respond, but because in the process of those tumor cells metastasizing, where little cells break off from the main tumor and spread through the body, they spread up into the abdomen, into the lung, and some of them get into the brain. When they get into the brain, that is a sanctuary against drugs. Very few drugs penetrate the blood-brain barrier. That is, you inject the drug into the blood, and it's carried to the brain, but the brain has a barrier that does not allow the drug to penetrate into the brain cells. And the cisplatin drug, apparently, for most types of cancer, is not able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. Therefore, we lose 15% of the patients because of the metastases to the brain. The rest of their bodies are clean. We have wiped out all of the cancer in the rest of their bodies, but they die of metastatic brain cancer from that type of cancer. This has stimulated a significant amount of activity in many places around the world looking for other modifications of the molecule which will enable it to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And so far, nothing has appeared successful. However, it turns out that in some types of brain cancers, not metastatic cancers to the brain, but cancers which start in the brain, like gliomas, that there is indeed some activity of the platinum drug against it. Apparently what happens in those cases is that where the tumor is growing, it breaks down that blood-brain barrier, and now the drug can get in to that kind of tumor, and it does have an effect. This is now being studied extensively in a number of institutions. All right. That's the work with testicular cancers, and it is probably the most successful result in treatment of cancers today. The next one that historically evolved was that of the ovarian cancers, and this was done primarily through the initial work of Dr. Eve Wiltshaw at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London. And she was able to show the high degree of activity of the cisplatin drug alone against the ovarian carcinomas. And she's a very charming person and a very delightful and brilliant doctor. She's in charge of the gynecologic cancer clinic at the hospital. And I recall once having a beer with her outside of the Queen's Elm, in the Queen's Elm Court Inn, near the Chester Beatty Institute. And I was rather unhappy about the fact that progress was so slow in moving drugs into the clinic. And she kind of commiserated with me for a while, but then she said something interesting. She had been in clinical research and treatment of ovarian cancers for about 15 years by that time, so she's still relatively young. When she first started, they were delighted if they could even just get the fever in a patient down. And now we're talking about cures. I think that statement perked me up quite considerably, that maybe progress isn't quite so slow after all. All right, the results with ovarian carcinoma, again in a combination chemotherapy that was evolved in a number of different institutions and tested out, and is continually evolving. All of these are continually being tested, improvements being made, and the results are being published, and you always see better and better results. So that as of the latest result, which was published a few months ago, for ovarian cancers, again advanced ovarian cancers, where it's metastatic up into the chest cavity, the results are as follows. Complete remissions, 69%. No evidence of disease. 19% partial remissions. The tumors have regressed, but they have not yet completely disappeared. And a few percent non-responders. Out of the 69% that were in complete remission, most of them are still in remission. And according to previous studies, if you can get them into complete remission now with these kinds of therapies, now they stay in remission and they do not relapse. Usually, if they're going to relapse, they relapse early. Say within the first 9 to 12 months. And now that we have many of those patients that are out to 5 years with no relapses. And so, again, the medical fraternity is now calling ovarian cancer a curable cancer. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to be cured by it, but apparently a significant fraction, and an increasing fraction with time. The third story I'd like to tell you a little bit about is one type of lung cancer, since Dave raised the issue of the smoking business. There are four major types of lung cancers, and the worst one is called oat cell cancer of the lung, because it was the fastest killer. It turns out that that one particular cancer is the most drug sensitive, and there are a number of drugs which are active against it. And now you start to mix the drugs in combinations. And what happens? Well, in one test that was done by Dr. Wittes at Sloan Kettering, they took 38 patients with advanced terminal oat cell cancer of the lung, and they treated them with a combination of two drugs, the cisplatin and VP16, another new drug, both of which had shown activity by themselves, but together it would be expected they would get synergism, and indeed it did. Out of those 38 patients, 17 went into complete remission, 17 into partial remission, and only 4, no response at all. Out of the 17 that went into complete remission, about 60% of them are still alive 5 years later. They considered those patients cured. But in the meantime, they've made a modification of the therapy. They've added another type of combination, and they alternate the one I told you with this new type called CAV. It's a combination of Cytoxan, Adriamycin, and Vinblastine. So they alternate the cisplatin VP16 once a month, and then the second month they give the CAV, and then back to cisplatin, and they keep alternating. With this regimen, they now are able to get well over 80% into complete remission. And they're starting to move up in towards the 90% in some of the cases now. So we have then good reason to believe, and the Dr. Wittes has now specified, that he considers oat cell a curable cancer. And so what we have then are the stories for three particular types of cancer which have been moved from the non-curable to the curable column through the use of the cisplatin drug, plus other new drugs that we now have in the stable in the medical profession. These are probably the outstanding examples, but I want to point out that we're starting to move in early days in the same way with a number of other cancers, head and neck cancers, where cisplatin now has produced a number of patients in complete remission and is now affecting about 80% of the patients that are treated in a positive way. Bladder cancers, it is the best, most active drug by itself, but we still have not yet gotten an improvement by going into a combination chemotherapy. But many places are now working on this. There's a very large bladder cancer project going under the stimulation of the Cancer Institute to try to develop a combination using cisplatin and others to get improved results in bladder cancers. And more interesting recently is prostate cancer, because there we're able to get all of the soft tissue where the cancer is growing completely clean of cancers by a combination of platinum and Adriamycin. And the bone metastases, which usually occurs very early on and therefore before most of the patients become aware they have the cancer, usually are not affected by the drugs, but radiation can handle that to a reasonable degree. But there's something much more interesting that has emerged also. When prostate cancer metastasizes to the bone, it becomes extremely painful. And the pain is so severe that even opiates can't handle it. However, for some unknown reason, but now being investigated, when they start the treatment with the platinum drug, the pain disappears. And despite the fact that in the early days there was a very heavy penalty the patients paid for taking the platinum, which I'll discuss in a moment, they looked forward to the platinum therapy because did not want the pain to come back. And so this has turned out to be true of a number of other cancers as well, where there's severe pains, that it can be relieved by the chemotherapy treatment. And so that's an unknown mechanism that's causing it, and it is being studied. Now, there are some cancers, however, where the results are not quite as exciting as one would like, but they're starting to move up towards them even at an earlier stage. There are two childhood cancers, osteogenic sarcoma and neuroblastomas, and these are becoming quite sensitive to combinations with the platinum drug. Indeed, there was one report about a year ago where, after surgery, where they used the platinum drug for the treatment of the remaining cancers, they had 10 out of 10 patients and went into complete remission and are remaining in remission up to the present. So that it looks quite active against this particular type of cancer and this second one for children as well. Cervical and uterine cancers are also beginning to respond quite nicely, and new therapies are beginning to emerge on that, and we see new reports almost every month of activity against these. Breast cancer apparently is not that terribly exciting at the present stage when you give the drug in the standard way by putting it into the intravenous drip line. However, there is a new method of treatment which is being studied at MD Anderson Hospital, where they're suggesting that what you want is to really get a high concentration of the drug in a local region where you have a large tumor. And you'll make that tumor mass go away and reduce the tumor burden in the patient, and perhaps the immune system of the host can take care of the rest of it. Well, they started to do this work on malignant melanomas. And that is another tumor that is now beginning to respond very actively to the cisplatin drug alone. And now we're going to start moving towards combinations in that treatment too. But what they do is they give the drug intra-arterially. That is, they find an artery that is just coming into the organ where the cancer is growing, and they put the drug into that artery. And when they do that, the malignant melanomas are responding very, very nicely, but then so are breast cancers. They're getting very lovely results on heavily pre-treated patients with breast cancer using the intra-arterial technique. This is all very early days for this kind of work. The reports are just coming out now. Probably it'll be about another year or two before we have a good evaluation of the system. But it does look quite promising. Meanwhile, a number of other cancers have been added to the active list. That is where the cisplatin drug has a high degree of activity. Adrenal cancers, which are very rare but very dangerous. They usually are deadly within a short period of time. Hodgkin's disease, where patients have been treated by the standard therapy and have failed, are now responding, and a number of them have been put into complete remission with the platinum drug. And so on and so forth. I just don't want to simply list all of the cancers that are being involved, but obviously it's turning out that in humans as well as in animals, as was predicted from the animal studies, we have here active combinations with a broad spectrum of activity. Not just one or two types of cancers, but apparently most of the major solid cancers are now responding. In the past, the only success we've had in cancer has been the treatment of leukemias or lymphomas, the so-called disseminated cancers, the blood cancers. Now we can treat solid cancers, and after all, solid cancers make up 92% of the total number of cancers that people get. So hard metastatic cancers are now treatable. Some of them curable, and the rest are beginning to move in that direction. I think then you can see why I'm so optimistic about the prognosis for the future with regard to the chemotherapy of cancers. However, I'd like to point out that we fail in a certain number of cases, and even these cases are interesting. This is an old slide. I just don't bother to keep up to date with the cancer responses. We fail on colon cancer. I must split this off because we're now getting some successes in rectal cancers. But colon is a definite failure. And it's unfortunate because there is no good therapy for colon cancers. Stomach was considered to be a failure. And unfortunately, we had developed a lovely theory as to why we should fail in the stomach and in the colon. And then a doctor in Spain came up with a test result which she reported in Brussels last October, where she had 10 patients and with advanced metastatic stomach carcinoma, failed on all previous therapies, responded beautifully to the cisplatin. 5 of them went into remission and 2 of them into complete remission. That's just with the single drug alone. So this is now questionable. I'd like to see that result verified in another clinic before I take it too seriously. I do like that theory. The basic idea is that the colon and stomach have something unique which blocks the cisplatin drug from acting. Remember I showed you those two chlorides on it? Well, they have to come off in order for the drug to act on the cells. And if there's high chloride in the cells, it doesn't come off. And colon and stomach are the two highest chloride-containing cells in the body. So here we have a drug, which, if you follow the alimentary canal down the body, is very active in head and neck cancers, in the larynx, pharynx, and esophagus, stops dead at the stomach, according to previous tests, doesn't work in the colon, both of which have this high chloride, and then starts to work again in the rectum, where again it goes down to low chloride. So we begin to see some reason why it should fail, and that tells us what to do. We must devise a modification which will still be able to become an active drug in the presence of high chloride. We now have a few such drugs in our laboratory and some other places, and they're undergoing early stage animal testing at the present time. So here at least the failures have taught us something. The other failure, of course, is the brain, but as I mentioned to you earlier, there are beginning to be some successes with some of the brain cancers, and these are indeed promising, but I'm not terribly enthusiastic. We are still looking for drugs which will penetrate the blood-brain barrier to be able to treat both the tumors which originate in the brain and those which are metastasized to the brain. And so this is the kind of work that's going on around the world now. The drug is available in the United States and in many foreign countries, and the clinical studies are underway, sponsored by international organizations all through Europe and America, and particularly by the National Cancer Institute. And they're now beginning to look at second-generation platinum drugs, which in animal studies appear to be better than the first one. And these are now moving up towards human clinical trials. And one of them is already on trial in Paris, and about four others are now going on clinical trials in the United States. And we would hope that some of these will show improved responses and diminished toxicities. Now, what are the toxicities? After all, generally, whenever you take a drug, you pay a penalty. Most of them are rather moderate penalties, otherwise you wouldn't take the drug. The penalty you pay was the renal toxicity, the kidney damage I mentioned, but we found ways to obviate that. So it's no longer a problem in the treatment. However, there's one other toxicity that's caused by the platinum drug, and that's nausea and vomiting. And I take no pride in saying that the platinum drug is probably the most nauseating drug ever discovered. And a lot of patients who were successfully being treated with the platinum drug refused further therapy, facing death as the alternative because of the severe nausea and vomiting. Something had to be done about that aspect of the drug, and something was done. It was discovered again quite by accident. 100% of the patients in the early days were throwing their guts up right after the administration of the drug for a period of up to 24 hours or so. A young man, by the way, this is a somewhat apocryphal story because I've heard it from both the Sloan Kettering Institute and the same story from the Sidney Farber Institute in Boston. But nevertheless, I pass it on because it's interesting. A young man was being treated for testicular cancer with the cisplatin drug. And the doctor set him up in the room in the hospital and then left him. And he expected to come back a few hours later and find the fellow in the bathroom throwing up his guts. Instead, as he walked down the hall, there was the kid coming towards him whistling. And the doctor stopped him and said, "Didn't you take the platinum therapy?" And the kid said, "Yes." Well, the doctor's curiosity became piqued because 100% of the patients are nauseous afterwards. And he began to query the kid, and it eventually came out that he was doing something that he wasn't supposed to be doing. He was smoking marijuana. And this started the study of the use of marijuana in the amelioration of the nausea and vomiting from cancer chemotherapy. This was Dr. Salen at the Sidney Farber Institute, was the first one to institute the studies. But, of course, marijuana is interdicted by the FDA, and therefore rules have to change, and the government has to relax its rules a bit to allow it to be used for medical purposes, and they're god-awful slow in doing so. And so while this is going on, and patients are somewhat illegally being given marijuana by the doctors, we've had to find some alternate methods that are acceptable today of drugs that are presently available to treat the nausea and vomiting. The earlier drugs, Compazine-type drugs, did not seem to have much of an effect. Fortunately, within this last year, three other techniques have become available, all of which have tested out very nicely, and they just about remove all of the nausea and vomiting. The best of the combinations is a Valium tablet, 10 milligrams, the day before the treatment, and a new drug called Toracan, which is an anti-emetic agent. And the combination of those two has just about removed the nausea and vomiting to the vanishing point. And so we finally are able to stop worrying about that. And now that we have finally successfully discovered ways of getting around the side effects of the platinum drug, that are the two dominant ones that were distasteful to the patients, the kidney toxicity and the nausea and vomiting, up comes somebody with a new modification of a platinum drug, which in animal tests does not show either kidney toxicity or nausea and vomiting as side effects. But what other side effects it will produce, we don't know yet. But there, at least there's that hope that if we needed to go that way, it is available. And so what I want to point out to you is that the results at the present time, I think, provide a fairly secure basis for optimism. Not guarded anymore, but just sheer optimism. The improvement in the therapies are growing at an exponential rate at the present time. The new therapies, the better results, are coming along all the time. That does not mean that we still do not have a severe problem. We do. We have an awful lot of different cancers that are still untreatable, but we are working on them, and the chances of success are quite significantly improved. After all, it's an astonishing thing. If you can give a drug to a patient and then watch in the lung pictures a mass of tumor tissue on the order of pounds disappear without any side effects that are unacceptable to the patient, that's an astonishing thing. Why aren't we drastically disturbing the normal functions of the body? And obviously we're not. We're able to do that with one tumor. We're now able to do it with about four tumors, five tumors, six tumors. We can just extend this on with additional work. It was that first breakthrough of the testicular cancers which gave us the basis and the reasons for wanting to push forward with this degree of optimism.